Hello, I'm Michaela Maguire, Artistic Director of Melbourne Writers Festival. You're listening to a conversation from our 2021 podcast series, which is supported by the Copyright Agency's Cultural Fund.
Hello, welcome to this Melbourne Writers Festival podcast, Internal Affairs with Claire Thomas and Meg Mason. I would like to respectfully acknowledge that we're recording this conversation on unceded sovereign land. I'm speaking to you from the beautiful lands of the Boonwurrung people of the Kulin Nation, and I pay my respects to their elders past and present. I also acknowledge all First Nations people who are listening and pay respects to elders and traditional owners wherever this podcast reaches you. My name is Veronica Sullivan. I'm the head of programming at the Wheeler Centre for Books, Writing and Ideas. And I'm joined by two really incredible writers to discuss their phenomenal novels. Let me introduce you to them both. Claire Thomas is the author of the internationally published novel, The Performance. Her first novel, Fugitive Blue, won the Dobby Award and was longlisted for the Miles Franklin. Claire has a PhD from the University of Melbourne, where she taught for many years. Hi, Claire.
Hello.
Our other guest is Meg Mason. Meg began her career at the Financial Times and the Times of London. She has written humour for The New Yorker and was a regular contributor to Vogue, Elle and Marie Claire before turning to fiction full-time. Sorrow and Bliss is her third book. Hello, Meg.
Hi, how are you? I wish I had a PhD as well. I feel intellectually intimidated.
Good.
I don't have one either.
Oh, there's still time. There's still time.
It's true. Look, I'm so excited about this conversation and I think we'll just jump into it. And I'd love to start by maybe giving readers a little sense of both of your books and of some of the characters that they might meet within them. So, Claire, maybe we'll begin with you with the three characters that anchor your novel, which takes place over one night during a performance of Samuel Beckett's play Happy Days, and alternates between the perspectives of three women of different generations who are in the room. You bring your reader incredibly close to each of these women's interiorities and give us a sense of the scope of their lives. And you also succeed in keeping their perspectives differentiated, even though we are so close to each of them. Can you tell me a little about these three characters and how you structured and wove together their different perspectives to create the shape of the novel?
So I started with the first character that we meet, whose name's Margot. She's in her early 70s. And when I started writing, she was almost a reflection of the character in the play that they're watching. So the play is very, it's a simple premise. There's a woman buried up to her waist in the earth on stage and they're all watching this play. I started with Margot. She moved beyond being a reflection of the character in the play, but with her I wanted to write about the university environment but from a perspective very different to my experience, so not a sort of exploited long-term casual employee. So I kind of extended my imagination and wrote about a tenured professor and to kind of still use that arena. And then the next character, I just wanted to have someone who wasn't just a straightforward audience member, so I hit on the idea of an usher. And so Summer is the usher in the play, in the novel, and she's in her early 20s. And then I kind of thought, well, I've got a 70-something, a 20-something, and I just kind of split the difference and thought I'd do someone in their early 40s. So it was quite pragmatic evolution of the characters. And then in terms of the question in how it was structured, I kind of broke down the play they were watching and into sections and worked out how many chapters I was going to write. So I kind of had a macro structure. And then I looked at certain things that came up in the play, and there were a couple of things I particularly wanted a certain character to grapple with. And so that's how I worked out the order of how to actually write the characters and present the characters.
Beautiful. Thanks, Claire. And those three different generational perspectives allow you to explore really different experiences of women at different stages of life. And I'd love to come back to each of these three women throughout our conversation today because they are all so distinctive and memorable in their own ways. But first, Meg, I wonder if you could introduce us to your equally indelible narrator, Martha, and tell us a little bit about her. Sorrow and Bliss has been widely praised for its unflinching and empathetic depiction of the impacts of mental illness, and importantly for showing what this can look like both for those who experience mental illness themselves and those who love them. And Martha, your narrator, she's unforgettable, so multidimensional, sometimes charismatic, sometimes insightful, sometimes infuriating, hilarious, pitiable, desperate. I swung between all of those feelings towards her, but the empathy, I think, from you as a writer and for the reader is so present. Can you tell us a little bit about Martha and about how her mental illness manifests and how you balance empathy across her story but also for her loved ones?
Sure. You know how it's all – thank you for that lovely description. It's always so tricky to describe your own book in, you know, in sort of brief when you've needed 90,000 words to tell the story. But I read a description of it by somebody on Instagram, which I'm not usually on, but somebody who posts under the name Book Slut. And she said the whole novel, the premise is British woman has a shit time in life surrounded by a Technicolor cast of characters. And I just think that's the best description I could wish for. So with my thanks to at Book Slut for that, it was a gift. So Martha is the British woman at the center of that. She's in her early 40s for the sort of when she's serving as the narrator. We first meet her when she's about to turn 40. We then revert to her at 17, which is when the moment in her life when she, as she describes it, a little bomb went off in her brain. She had some sort of mental, I guess, breakdown, as it used to be called, and from, you know, which left her unlike herself, changed sort of with a mental condition that continued throughout her life, for which she was never able to sort of get an accurate diagnosis. So she moves into her adult life with this sort of mystery at the center of her existence. And there's almost a sort of degree of arrested development. She feels completely defined and controlled by this force. You know, she knows there's something wrong with her. It impacts her relationship with her parents, Celia and Fergus, with her sort of beloved sister, Ingrid, to whom she's really close, and then to her husband, Patrick, her second husband, Patrick. She's a disastrous start of marriage in the middle there to a sort of absolute weapon called Jonathan. And again, she would say that that marriage broke down because of this illness. And what I sort of wanted to explore, apart from the impact of that not knowing, is the idea of where her illness ends and where she begins, and the extent to which after that sort of 20 years of questing for a diagnosis unsuccessfully, you know, there's a void that needs a label in it. So a label rushes in and she decides that, you know, she's difficult and too sensitive. And she says that eventually, you know, her family and friends become, you know, come to concur with this diagnosis, which she then finally receives. And the question of the novel then becomes, is it too late? You know, what to do with this final revelation that comes at 41 when she's on the verge of, you know, Patrick leaving, Ingrid barely speaking to her. And so that is how we proceed towards the end.
Beautiful. Thank you, Meg. I love the word Technicolor in there, in that Instagram quote that you mentioned. I feel like that is such an important aspect of the book, which is that it's so full of life, even though it's about mental illness and it has some really dark aspects. There's this sense of life and of love and of joy and of black humor woven through it, which makes it such a joy to read. You've talked a little bit about the moving back and forth and the sort of structural progression that isn't necessarily linear of Martha's life, and I'm interested in looking at these two novels together, that they're very different in their scope of time that they encompass. The performance obviously takes place over one night, while Sorrow and Bliss does span decades of a life from childhood or adolescence to adulthood. But neither of them are linear, and they do have these discursions back and forth through time, which is so rich as a character study to show different aspects of somebody and how they may have informed them at different stages in their life. And I'm very interested in those choices about scope and about timelines when you're looking at a life of a character and how you navigate where you begin and where you end and where you make your stops along the way. So Meg, I might direct that to you first of all, because we've been talking a little bit about Martha's life and how it unfolds. How do you choose those sort of directions and jumps around in her experience?
Well, before it became a book with mental illness as kind of the axis around which the story turns, it was a love story first and foremost. And what I wanted to do is chart the course of their relationship over a really long span of time. Mm. I sort of loved the idea that Patrick, they met when Martha was 17 and he was 14, which is obviously an age whereby he'd be completely invisible to her. He sort of comes along to a family Christmas as a boarding school stray, like a friend of one of her cousins. And it's over the, he's in love with her instantly. And she kind of doesn't notice him until, you know, she's had this starter marriage and then realizes that he's been sort of a singularly consistent force in her life or presence in her life. And I just wanted to chart that. And I wanted to capture the sort of intimacy and shorthand that is formed in that long relationship. And what, I suppose what romance almost means beyond being proposed to at the top of the Eiffel Tower, you know, which is not where he does it. He actually does it leaning against the kitchen bench. But in terms of that's a point at which a lot of novels stop. But I think, you know, as someone who's in my early 40s, who's been married for almost more than half my life, actually, I realize, I sort of am really interested to explore that and to sort of see where a couple can end up and where they can go and what the challenges are in the middle and the sort of forces that are arrayed against long relationships and just, yeah, and essentially the commitment and achievement and sort of earnestness that they all put into that, you know, the two of them, despite everything in Martha's diabolical sort of self-sabotaging and occasionally, you know, beastly behavior to Patrick and his own sort of emotional issues that come out of what she diagnoses as sort of boarding school syndrome, they are both so earnest. And I think even though their marriage is coming to an end and they may not get what they want, specifically what they wanted in life, I just think in real life as much as in fiction, if there has been that commitment, there will be sort of some fruit that comes out of that. And it may not be what you expected or hoped for, but there is something on the other side of that sort of post-hope and what they describe as sort of injury time that they weren't entitled to. So that's kind of, that's how the span needed to stretch from 17 to 41.
And it's so affecting being able to follow their relationship and see its trajectory. I hope this doesn't sound corny, but this is how I feel, which is that some characters you sit with in your mind and you think about them a lot, but these Martha and Patrick, I feel like it's sitting in my heart and that's kind of where they belong. And it is a love story, even though, you know, there are, you're kind of playing with a lot of those expectations around genre. It's still, it's a heart book, and that's, you know, that's what I love as a reader. What about you, Claire? We've talked about setting the book in a single night, and I'm really interested. I think that can present a lot of opportunities, but also some interesting constraints. And I'd love to hear about how you navigated those and whether it was sort of an exercise in boundary setting for yourself or whether it allowed you to do things that you might not have otherwise been able to.
Yeah, so both. Both options there. I definitely enjoyed the constraint of having it take place within the duration of a single performance of a play. So it's even more contained than a night. There's a little bit of kind of entering into the theatre and a tiny bit of exiting the theatre, but it is literally, you know, during the play and the interval time. And so, as I mentioned before, I worked out which section was going to be with each character and kind of had them watching that segment of the play. But what that did was that was the only constraint. So the rest of it was in their minds, and there were certain, each of them have their own preoccupations this night, this moment in time that they bring to the theatre with them. And so there was that sort of further anchoring the scope of it, I suppose. But then beyond that, I could go absolutely anywhere internally, and anything that they wanted to think about at any point in their life was fine. You know, that it was just whatever, wherever the digressions kind of ended up, I followed. And so there are childhood kind of memories, and there are thinking about a few hours earlier in that day or a year before or whatever. So there, yes, the constraint was paradoxically extremely liberating and enabling, because it kind of, I went all over the place, and then I kind of got, then I snapped back into the theatre, sort of like them, you know, and the reader. I think you get consumed by sort of digressions and sometimes triggered from what they're watching and sometimes just another kind of something physical that they might be experiencing, like within the actual space, and then they'd come back to it. And I wanted them to be contained literally, so they're in their seats, and then so that's one containment. And then there's also this sense of the theatre space as a kind of cold, isolated, bubble, and then there's so there's layers of containment and scope, and but it was fun.
Yeah, fantastic. And you know, that structure, when you were talking about how you fit that all together, that's a huge amount of work, but it feels effortless in the reading. But at the same time, obviously there are these links, as you say, between what's happening on the stage, what's happening for the characters, or they go on trains of thought spurred by something they're seeing on stage, or sometimes the action or the dialogue in the play seems to uncannily respond to something that they're thinking about, and there's this really interesting interplay between the performance on stage and what's happening in their minds, in the audience, and we're right there with them. It's so wonderful. I'd love to also get stuck into some of the human, I think we're already here actually, but some of the human kind of themes and relationship explorations in your book, because you've both written very differently, I must say, but you've both written characters who are in marriages that contain love, yes, but also illness of some kind, and also violence, whether physical or emotional violence. And in your book, Claire, that's Margot's husband, who has early onset dementia, and she's questioning whether his increasingly violent behaviour can be explained or excused by his illness. It's such a heart-wrenching conundrum and uncertainty to be in her with, this strong woman. And of course, in Sorrow and Bliss, Martha's unpredictable moods are born very stoically by Patrick up to a point. And I think for me, both of those dynamics lead me, or lead a reader, to think about what a relationship can withstand, how much it can withstand, and how people experience and negotiate romantic relationships that sometimes can seem like they're the opposite of love. So Claire, can you tell me a little about Margot's experience, and particularly the stage of life that she's at and the stage that her marriage is at when we meet her?
Yeah, so they've been together for over 40 years, and I wanted it to be a sense that their marriage was a strong one, that it was a positive relationship. She wasn't just sticking around because she had no imagination, or you know, but there's this, yes, as you mentioned, this new aspect of the relationship, which is his occasional violence. And what I wanted to grapple with was how that kind of inflected the whole relationship, like this new component. How did it kind of recalibrate the way she perceived the marriage, you know, the whole marriage, whether there was, whether it kind of diminishes the whole thing, or whether it was something that was always like an underlying potential act. Mm. And also I wanted them to have a particularly physical relationship, like, so that they're lovers, they're long-term lovers. I wanted that to be there. So the bodily betrayal of her is even more heightened, because that's where their greatest connection lies, in the physical, despite them both being kind of brainy. So, yeah, and she cannot really, she can't resolve what it means, what's going on now, what it means, and she hasn't talked about it. She's in denial, and I didn't want it to just be a very black and white thing, because that's someone you've loved for 40 years, that it isn't a black and white thing. Mm. So it's not like, that's it, I'm out of here, you know, like it, so yeah, I hoped it would be a grappling and a nuanced relationship. Yep.
Mm, absolutely. I think it is those things. Meg, do some of those things that Claire was just talking about resonate or connect at all in your mind to Martha and Patrick's relationship? Because theirs is so, so deep, but so volatile a lot of the time that we're privy to. And I wonder if you could talk a little about, I think, Claire, you said it can recalibrate how you see marriage, and I'm interested in how Martha's mental illness challenges she and Patrick as individuals and as a couple.
That's such a good question. I think that I read somebody say once that in romantic relationships, your strengths attract to each other, but so do your weaknesses. So your weaknesses, you know, they're drawn in the same way, and they kind of conspire, I suppose, against you. But I also think that dysfunction is often sown into a long-term relationship very early on. Like, probably those patterns are being established before you've even had your fourth date. You know, so as you progress through, so the example with Martha and Patrick would be, soon after they get married, she enters one of her periodic depressions. And for the first time, she starts throwing things. And, you know, she later talks about how when she receives the diagnosis that it was never her, which is always her suspicion, which she wasn't really able to articulate. She was always full of shame about it, but she still couldn't not do it. She felt like it was this condition that raised her arm. And if Patrick really does have, and I think he does, what she describes as boarding school syndrome, which is sort of a newly, like a legitimate existing condition, with symptoms like, you know, if you're one of those British men who's been sent to boarding school at 6 or 7 and essentially raised yourself in a hostile and emotionally, you know, repressed environment where you needed to be self-sufficient, self-contained, you know, and absolutely stoic from the age of 6 or 7, you're going to have, you know, the symptoms that Ed described is emotional repression, being unable to ask for help, unable to express emotion. And that's the weakness that he has that's drawn to her, because she gives him something to tolerate and to stoically overcome. And he's not able to say, you know, you can't treat me that way. You know, he just absorbs it because he's there. And he doesn't, I suppose, think it's normal as well, but he wouldn't have the language to say, this isn't all right. I deserve to be sort of treated, you know, better than that. And what she then, you know, as this complete force that she is, you know, it's always her version of the story. He lets it be. He's the peacemaker. He accepts it. And she, you know, even though she's the one who readers sort of tend to blame solely for the collapse of their marriage, I just don't believe that one person can destroy their marriage on their own. I just think there's always got to be a contribution from both, even if it's not equally weighted. And she, whilst being fully apologetic about the way that she, you know, has treated him, she does come to see his passivity as a really negative contribution, because she just, as it were, let him dominate her. Let her dominate him. And, you know, that's kind of not a healthy dynamic, but they're so entrenched, you know, after however long it is, they've been married 8 or 10 years, they can't see another way. And so even when she gets this diagnosis and it all makes sense, she doesn't have another way of treating Patrick. And her sister says to her, you know, if you're so much better, you know, because she finally gets the medication that works, if you're so much better, why are you still treating that, you know, Patrick like that? And she just says, because I don't know how else to treat him, you know, sort of 6 months of wellness against a lifetime of illness. They're just so stuck in those roles. But hopefully there is still, you know, readers still have that sense of how desperately in love they are and how much they want to be together, you know, straining against this force. And so it sounds peculiar, but I just love them both. And the whole way through, I just wanted the best for them, you know. And it's sort of that thing. It's the same as the relationship she has with Ingrid. Ingrid is sort of the last man standing when it comes to putting up with Martha. She's still clinging on for dear life at the end, because she's the only one who just all the way through knew that this wasn't Martha, gave her the benefit of the doubt, always thought the best of her. And I think that's what really draws me to sibling relationships as something to explore in fiction, because I think they are utterly unique. I think there's not a friendship like them. There's not a romantic relationship like them, because this is the person that was in it with you, you know, who was the co-survivor of that childhood, the only other person who saw it from the inside and knows how you were both shaped. And so I think those are the things, in a way, as well as being a love story between Patrick and Martha, I've always wanted it to seem like a love story between Martha and Ingrid as well.
Yeah, absolutely. We love Ingrid. And the way you talk about the force is making me think almost of like magnets, where you have these magnets that can either repel completely or stick together immediately. And it's that kind of undeniable force, and you find a way to navigate it. You mentioned also then Martha's diagnosis and the sense of solace and clarity that gives her, which you make the very deliberate choice not to name, and you specifically note at the end of the book that this is not depicting a specific condition. But that choice seems to have made her more relatable, not less, for many readers. Have you been surprised by the extent to which readers have connected with Martha and what people bring to and take from her experience and her mental health struggles?
I've just been completely stunned by it. I'm always so grateful when I feel that readers understood why I did it, because I know that it was kind of an odd choice, and I know that it has infuriated a sort of segment who felt that they deserved to know, you know, if they'd put however many pages into finding out. But it was never a detective story. You know, I wasn't interested in sort of making it about that illness, but I think it enables people to put whatever condition they want in there and to put their own experience in there. And it just, creatively speaking, means that Martha isn't that thing, because if we knew and if it was in the blurb and if it was, you know, if we had the knowledge that she didn't have, then she would never have anything but our almost judgment and, you know, our sort of analysis of her from the beginning. And if she did something, we would say, oh, well, that's a typical symptom of, you know, whatever condition it is we know about. So I'm always hugely glad. But what I also find really strange is when there are people who find her purely unlikable, which I do understand, I'm always surprised that often in tandem with that is a sort of argument or a sense they give that she should just pull herself together and they just want to shake her. And, you know, she infuriates them and she's so self-sabotaging and they can't bear her. But I'm so surprised by that because she's a representation of someone who's mentally ill. And I know that physical illness is not completely analogous and it's quite reductive to say, oh, it's just like a broken leg. I mean, it's so much more complicated than that. You know, it has its own sort of, well, but at the same time, you would never say to someone, oh, I hate it how you vomit after chemotherapy. You know, it's so annoying. Why can't you just not do that? I just want to shake you. And so it's really opened my eyes to the fact that I don't know if we're as far along in the conversation about mental illness as we claim to be, because if people sort of express that opinion, then I don't know if we genuinely really believe that nobody would behave like that if they had the choice. No one would consider Martha's behavior aspirational and think, I'm just going to treat my family and my husband atrociously because I enjoy being this person. So I suppose, you know, in a slightly facetious way, I always think when people say she's so unlikable, I wish she'd pull herself together. I'm like, did you read the part about the mental illness though? Because that's to me so core to forgiving her, which is what we need to do.
Absolutely. That's really interesting. And staying in that realm of mental illness, or I suppose forces beyond the individual's control that can impact us deeply. Claire, I'd like to talk about climate anxiety in the performance because it's such a present in a way that I haven't seen, but I think is happening more and more in contemporary fiction, but probably was not there, you know, a few generations ago for obvious reasons. So the performance takes place at the height of the Australian bushfire season, and the contrast between that hermetically sealed theatre space that you've touched on, that's cool and air conditioned, and then at the outside is this hazy, smoke choked city. It's a really stark contrast, and there's this looming threat of bushfires, which is very present and particularly felt deeply by Summer, the youngest protagonist, the Usher, who her girlfriend is driving to visit her parents in the heart of bushfire country. So it's, she's got this personal and existential anxiety and concerns swarming around her, and it's very omnipresent. And in, you know, reading this at the lead up to Summer, it led me to think about bushfires have come to signify something very potent and are very deeply embedded in the Australian psyche, and have to some degree potentially eclipsed the lightness and joy that we would have historically associated with summer and the onset of warm weather. So I just love you to speak about the significance and the presence of climate anxiety in the performance, particularly for summer, but it feels, you know, it pops up for everybody as well, I think.
I definitely wanted it to be there as a sort of hovering pressure. And so, and the fires make it explicit, but also, as you said, the fires are outside, away. So there's a sense of disconnect. And I wanted to write about climate anxiety, but I didn't want to kind of project the problem into a future scenario. I wanted to write about how three people were dealing with it in this moment. And so actually try and capture some sense of the ways in which people can deliberately or by their circumstances be separated from it. And yeah, so that's made literal by the theatre space. But it's also, you know, Margot at one point, there's a moment in the play where the character says something about the melting earth, and Margot's just like, what? Don't start on that. We're not talking about that. Like she deflects it, you know, and she's pissed off about the smoke haze. It's irritating her eyes and, you know, so that's a very kind of individuated and selfish and one might say boomery kind of feeling. But Summer, yes, quite before this night, she was already consumed by the reality of what was going on, and she cannot wade through all the things to worry about. Like she's just she has a heightened sense of awareness about everything, and it floods her, you know, the kind of, once she gets in a loop, she just cannot decipher how the world can be this way. And she's all, and I think she is also generationally emblematic. And I taught a subject for many years called Literature, Ecology, Catastrophe, which is quite self-evident what it's about. And my students were a very important part of my inspiration for summer, and their absolute articulate frustration and disbelief of how obvious the situation was, and yet how kind of helpless they could feel as a individual human within that. And yeah, Summer has a way of just cutting through and saying, you know, this is what is going on. And yeah, the question of what's going on with her girlfriend and where she is in terms of the fire zone, yes, it's all really laid on for Summer. But I lived in the Dandenong Ranges for several years, and it's interesting what you say about Summer, not the character, the season, as being on also almost now becoming synonymous with bushfire. And I feel that that's not how, that was not my experience of living in a fire zone. In fact, there's a certain quality of living in places like that where you are so aware of seasonal change and how that manifests as a joyful, enlivening reality, and that if you understand it, you understand there are really X amount of days where bushfires are a legitimate concern. And, you know, people can be quite scathing about the choices people make to live in those areas. But I would say that the bushfire threat it doesn't come close to overtaking the incredible life force of living in a place of that kind of natural beauty. But that's very specific. I also wanted to...
No, but it's beautiful.
Well, yeah, I mean, I understand that, and I wanted there to be a lived experience of just the reality of being in a fire zone. But also there's obviously a part of the book where these women are, they're Western women in a theatre. There's a sense of, you know, privilege as a buffer. I mean, that's obvious. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to touch on that a little bit in terms of the climate situation too. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. No, that's really, really interesting. And particularly the contrast between a character like Margot, for whom the reminder of the bushfire is an annoyance and something that she's just trying to not think about determinedly, whereas Summer, it's all she can think about, and it's completely distracting her from, well, everything relates back to it. Everything brings it back to her. I don't want to be reductive about generations, but there is something very interesting about even just what you mentioned, like the student, that your students, a lot of them were experiencing that as a kind of present, ever-present force in their lives.
And then the central character, which I didn't, she has a degree of actual agency and capacity because she's very wealthy and she's got money, and she's in a different position because she can literally affect change, but she's still unclear how much she can be responsible for, how much she should be responsible for. So yeah, she's kind of in an interesting midpoint there. She's not completely despondent and desperate and helpless, nor is she dismissive.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about Ivy, because we haven't given her much time yet, but she is such a fascinating character. And I'd like to talk specifically about her experience of motherhood or its lack. So she's a new mother in her early 40s whose first baby died of SIDS. And I'm very interested in the writing about that really raw space, which is so potent for so many women, both mothers and not mothers, about motherhood and its significance. And I'd love if you could talk a little bit about what that means for Ivy.
Yeah, so Ivy's certainly had a range of experiences as a mother, and she's, you know, the worst thing happened to her. And she didn't think that she would get past that, or that she would ever be a mother again, and she is. And how she is with her second child is very unproblematically joyful, which is quite an unusual depiction of motherhood, really. I mean, she's besotted and fine with that, and there's a sort of a celebration of that little person that I wanted to capture. But there's always the looming memory of what happened to her first baby, and that has impacted to some degree, but not too much, how she is with her new baby. Motherhood, yeah, it's everywhere in the book, and I wanted it to be, for there to be quite a range of mothering depicted and also being mothered. I mean, it's where we all start. Everyone's got a mother, or, you know, at some point, and then they might disappear, but that's still a thing. You know, it's bog standard life, mothering, and yet it's got this kind of exalted, all these kind of mythologies around it. And I wanted to convey a variety, you know, ambivalence and joy and delight and all of it. And, you know, you can have one child and experience all that. I've had three, and it's all, you know, there's a lot. It's all different. So, yeah, it's an ever-ending relationship,
yeah,
exploration, really.
It's a vast space.
Mm-hmm.
And, Meg, I'd love to turn to you on this note as well, because Martha is terrified of having children. She has a doctor who tells her when she's young that she shouldn't be a mother because of her mental health issues, and it becomes a fixation for her, but also something that for a long time, it's like she can't look directly at a desire to be a mother. It's like the sun, it's too bright to look at. Can you talk about the way that she thinks about or doesn't think about the desire to have children and how fraught that is to write?
Yeah, it's only occurred to me lately that I went on a podcast called How to Fail, and the premise is that you need to list three failures. And one of mine, which I hadn't talked about before, was that I believed everybody that told me I had children too young. So I had my first daughter at 25, which is sort of to obey a biological imperative. But in my social, you know, sociodemographic, it was a bit countercultural. And I didn't expect the reaction that I got, which was a sort of consensus from everybody I knew and everyone I ever met that I'd done it wrong. I'd scuppered my career and I, you know, all of those sorts of things. And what was I thinking? And, you know, they used to ask me first up if it was an accident. And every doctor that I saw sort of up to 16 or 17 weeks in my pregnancy, even though I was married and we owned a flat and we were both employed, they would say, "Are you happy about it?" That was always their first question. And that was, I realized much later, encoded to mean, "Do you want an abortion?" Which is a strange question to ask, you know, so late into my pregnancy. But the part that I took away from that was the "you did it wrong" narrative. And that settled on me at 25, you know, and to be asked if your child's an accident when your child is on your hip is a strange question. And I never thought to question it, because at 25, someone who's 40 seems incredibly adult, you know, and you just think they must know what they're talking about. So I then progressed through my experience of motherhood into my late 20s and 30s. And the recurring phrase in my mind was always, "I did it wrong. We did it wrong. We did it wrong. We did it wrong." And I stuck to that narrative. And instead of ever questioning it, I used everything that happened to us to stoke story and to prove it was true. So, you know, if we were sort of renting and we got evicted and didn't immediately have, you know, as in the landlord ended our lease and we didn't immediately have anywhere to go, it was because we did it wrong. And, you know, if we had some other sort of work catastrophe or one of us got made redundant, it's because we did it wrong and we had children too early. So I think in the same way, even though it's not an autobiographical novel, I wanted to give that to Martha, because this little bomb goes off in her brain when she's 17. And of course you don't question its truth when you've been told it by a 50-year-old, you know, very dismissive, probably white male specialist, who tells her in her first ever appointment that it's obviously glandular fever combined with hysterical female teenagerdom. But, you know, some teenagers, even though there's nothing you can do about glandular fever, some girls like to feel special by taking a tablet, in which case she can have an iron supplement. She just wants something to swallow. And so, you know, that was the narrative that she takes forward. And of course, what went with that was this, you know, exactly this warning not to have children, which even though every doctor she then sees would question the previous doctor's diagnosis, they would always issue the same injunction: you shouldn't have children, you need to be very careful. You know, either this medication is dangerous to a developing fetus, or you're going to pass on this condition, you know, guaranteed, or you're not going to be able to cope as a mother. And she doesn't think to question it until she sees a doctor at 40, who then finally diagnoses her. And a revelation comes with that, and she realizes that it was never true, you know, that she just believed it and accepted it. And even though I'm not the kind of writer who seeks to sort of advance the conversation or, you know, issue any kind of opinion on what I see. I just want to show what I see. It's been interesting that since I began the book and since the book came out, there has been, I think, a discernible raising of a conversation about medical misogyny mm-hmm. and the way that women have always, you know, since the dawn of time, been written off as hysterical and every, you know, our pain minimized and our sort of instinct minimized, you know, and especially I think, you know, we meet Martha when she's 17, which puts that in the kind of late 90s when we weren't as educated. It was pre-internet, you know, you weren't probably going to go down to the library and borrow the DSM, and teenagers couldn't have mental illness, you know, they just were moody. And so of course she's written off and she carries that through. And I just think that it was a really interesting thing that happened that, you know, I never consciously put that in, but here we are sort of talking about it and what it means to be, you know, cast as hysterical and how we're blamed for our own pain. And I also think, again, it's not autobiographical, but I've certainly had that experience of being, you know, patronized by a doctor and questioned and sort of almost told, you know, sometimes outright that, you know, you're just here because you want something to do. It's just to fill your day that you've come to see me. Or, you know, that sort of sense that you just, you know, go home and have a rest. It's all perfectly normal. Mm. And I just think that's something that I'm glad that I could put on the page. And I want to read so much more about it myself. And I want to see it challenged. And I want us to, you know, saying to someone the other day after seeing a rheumatologist who was just like, oh, of course you've got arthritis, but everyone, you know, going to get it eventually. Thanks very much. That'll be $900. I want to get to the point in my own life where, you know, it's instinctive. Within 2 minutes, you know that you're not going to, you know, enjoy and be treated well by this doctor. Just want to get to the point where I just stand up and say, thanks very much. That's amazing. I'll be on my way and just cruise straight past that cash register. Because I just think, why are we inclined to be so polite and to accept, you know, the narrative that we're given? And obviously for Martha, that has huge ramifications around motherhood, which exactly as you so beautifully say, means that she's just unable to face it because her terror of accidentally falling pregnant is so entrenched. But also the shame around it, I suppose, because to be told from that age that you shouldn't have children, I mean, that's just the most tremendous burden, because there's something wrong with you and you're not fit to be a mother, and the whole medical establishment is cautioning you against it and saying, don't do it, you're not fit for this. Which is obviously going to throw you outside the female experience, you know, and to sort of put you on the periphery of what we're all supposedly destined to do. And the sort of acme of the female experience is to have children. And she feels that she'll never experience that.
Oh, amazing. I mean, amen. May we all reach the stage of getting up and walking out of doctor's appointments when they're not serving us. I think that's, yeah. It's galvanizing. I can't let you go because we're running out of time, but I can't let you go without talking about the role that art plays in your characters' lives and in both of your books thematically. And Claire, we've talked a little about the structural kind of challenges and how deeply woven through the Beckett play is. But I'd like to ask you about the book's title because the performance is the literal play taking place on stage, but it also evokes the way that your protagonists are enacting their own lives with varying degrees of self-consciousness. Mm-hmm. You know, if anyone's ever been to a theatre show and stood in the foyer before or after, that is performances up the wazoo. And of course, we all move through the world performing to greater or lesser extent, you know, versions of the lives that we wish we had or we think we ought to have. So I'd love to hear from you about what draws you to the concept and the delivery of both the theatrical performance, but also the individual and the performances of life.
Yeah, well, I mean, it goes back to what Meg was just saying then about the stories that we tell ourselves, or the stories that are inflicted on us, and they can dictate how we are in so many different ways that are profound and more sort of banal. So yeah, I was definitely interested in grappling with all the different manifestations of the notion of performing, and I wanted to. That was originally the sort of germinating point of the whole novel, was watching a play and noticing someone else in the audience who was weeping, and it wasn't a sad piece of theatre, and I that just got me on this whole spiral of, we have no idea what's going on with the person that, you know, you're sharing an armrest with, and what they're seeing. It's apparently a collective experience watching a piece of theatre, or any sort of art going can often be collective, but I wanted to kind of heighten the subjective aspect of it and how complicated all that is, and that just the basic thing that you never have any idea what's going on with anybody else's life, and people can be very judgmental and very dismissive and reductive and quick to make assumptions. And so I've got that going on in lots of different ways in the novel. And the role of art, you kind of mentioned that. And for me, I think that for each of them, that there's different ways to which the art is a reflection or a mirror or a way of understanding or just another component of the story that they tell their life, or the way that they, you know, another layer of artifice or authenticity, which are very dubious categories. But yes, and where the site of reality is, that was also a big part of the idea of performance, that we're watching, they're watching something. Is what's going on in their head more real, or is the overt performance actually in some way truer? And so that's also the interval when I flipped it and made them the performers and the reader the audience, you know, it was all quite meta. But yeah, that's yes. All of that.
And I love the interval, because these are characters, yes, but people, women who we've been getting to know and seeing their inner selves and having this very close understanding of their interiority. And then we get to the interval and they've become actors, because we get to see them interacting with each other. And it's so delicious and kind of fascinating to feel like you know these people, but you don't know what's going to happen when they're actually crossing one another's paths necessarily. Like, that's such a, yes, it's a meta kind of conceit, but on a readership level, it's quite a delicious space to be able to observe, kind of voyeuristic almost. What about you, Meg, on that note of the role of the arts? And I feel like the arts are a very present force for Martha and her family. And maybe there's a class element to this, which we can also talk about, but her mother is a semi-notable sculptor who also has her own mental health challenges, which she seems to find an ability to express through her work. And Martha's father is a minor poet in the terms used, but a great lover of literature. And he also conveys that to Martha and imbues her with that love. And then Martha works in kind of culture adjacent, sometimes slightly more frivolous jobs throughout her career, including stints in publishing and magazines and eventually writing a funny food column. But she also ultimately comes to this place of really deep connection and engagement with writing as a source of respite and fulfillment. So I'm very interested in how you would characterise the role of art in your characters' lives, and particularly how you approached writing their relationship to art, given there's this often discussed nexus between mental illness and art, and you know, how or whether they interact in terms of creators.
That's such an interesting question that I've never been asked before, and I haven't noticed that before, about the fact that art is the kind of the world in which they're all contained, apart from Patrick, who's in medicine and therefore sits outside the culture of that family. That's such an amazing, thank you. That feels like a gift of an observation. It's weird to be kind of learning something new about your book 8 months after you finish writing it. I think, to an extent, it's the world that I know. I mean, I don't have a sculptor mother and a poet father, but you sort of, I guess, occupy that space vicariously by being a reader and, you know, being a maker in a way. I think some of it is just that, because this novel, when I was writing it, I believed that it was my last chance as a novelist, having failed on a manuscript before. This was sort of, I really felt my last hurrah. And if I wasn't going to achieve what I wanted to achieve, I wouldn't try again. I couldn't justify what would then become an extravagant hobby. But because it was my last attempt, I put everything in it that I've ever collected in, you know, as a writer, the way you keep little fragments of conversation that you overhear, or you highlight lines of things and copy them out into little notebooks and, you know, all of that sort of thing. And sometimes you would hold some of that back. You would think, oh, I'm going to save that for the next thing I'm writing. I'm not going to use that absolutely banging Virginia Woolf quote because I want to, you know, want to use it next time. But there was no reason to do that. So all of it went in. Everything I've ever seen, heard, felt, read, you know, every piece of art I've ever looked at, every song, every, you know, all of those things. And so I suppose that's some themes that run through there. There's also some, sorry, I don't know why I'm laughing at my own answer, but there's also some, I guess, in jokes with myself, as you know, as strange as that sounds. I guess when you've been an author and a female author, you acquire a certain bank of I guess warm resentment to the questions that you're often asked around autobiography, around your own experience of mental illness, all of those things, even sort of down to the just, you know, I suppose they're not gender specific, but questions along the lines of where do you get your inspiration? Do you set a special time aside to write? Those sorts of things, which just become sort of motifs. And so throughout, in terms of literature, there's little moments that I put in as jokes against that. So Martha, who wants to write a novel, she keeps trying to, but it keeps drifting towards autobiography. And she imagines being at a literary festival and somebody in the audience asking how autobiographical it is. And she'd have to say all of it. You know, there's not a shred of invention in there except that the husband I write about is presently unmurdered. And so that was sort of something that just, I suppose there's that aspect running through of literature. And there's also everything I know and that I've learned about writing is expressed between her and an older friend called Peregrine. And they sort of have jokes about what first novels are and what they achieve. And I suppose the part that I related to the most out of that, my own experience in as a writer, she talks about how when it keeps drifting to autobiography, there's a girl, and no matter how hard she tries, she is always on the stairs, and everything that happens to her happens unexpectedly, because unexpectedly is a word that I really grapple with not including in my fiction. It's one of those overuse, along with actually and slightly, which is apparently forbidden in all fiction. And so I suppose that's where it was. It's just an acquirement of things that I have learned and seen, you know, at 43 that I wanted to put in there. And then I just think, you know, we're all, if we're readers, then we know that feeling of being saved by it. So when Martha has to rebuild her life post her separation from Patrick, all she can think of to do is to go into her father's study and look at the books that he once said, you know, all of life is contained on this wall, and to take down, you know, she has categories of books that are books written by sensitive and depressive women, you know, books that she can reach without having to stand on a chair. And she gets those ones down and she reads them and she writes down everything that somebody wants in that book, because she's trying to find something else to want, having failed at her marriage and not achieved the thing she wanted in her adult life. And she says it's just always a home, a family, money, and belonging. And that's all anybody wants. And I suppose that's what we sort of see in literature, and see our own experience there, and to feel that we're part of a collective, I suppose, as human beings, not just individuals who are striving madly. So I think that's everything I feel about books and reading and art.
That's beautiful, and a beautiful note to end on. I think these are two novels that contain so many lives, and it's been a total privilege to speak to these two brilliant authors today. Thank you so much, Claire Thomas and Meg Mason. To our listeners, you can buy The Performance by Claire Thomas and Sorrow and Bliss by Meg Mason through MWF's partner bookshop Reading. Thank you so much for supporting Melbourne Writers Festival. And thanks for joining us for Internal Affairs.
Thanks for listening. To support Melbourne Writers Festival, you can make a donation of any size at mwf.com.au.